The top stories. U.S. President Joe Biden says NATO would respond if Russia uses a chemical weapon against Ukraine and calls for the expulsion of Russia from G20. The U.S. announces fresh sanctions on North Korea following Pyongyang's test launch of a new intercontinental missile. Also ahead, French unions hold fresh nationwide anti-government protests as France prepares for the presidential election next month. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. U.S. President Joe Biden warns Moscow that NATO would respond if Russia uses chemical weapons during its military operation in Ukraine. Speaking at a news conference after a NATO meeting on Ukraine, Biden said the nature of the response depends on the nature of the use of chemical weapons. He also pointed to the unity among the NATO member states in the face of Russia's offensive, saying the Russian president has failed to divide the West with his war on Ukraine. Meanwhile, he proposed Russia's removal from the group of 20 industrialized and developing nations. Since the beginning of the Russian military operation in Ukraine in late February, Western countries have responded by imposing crippling sanctions on Russia and sending military equipment to Ukraine. However, they are divided on issues such as imposing further sanctions on Russia and the establishment of a no-fly zone proposed by Ukraine. To give us some insight into that story, I'm going to bring in Mr. Dmitry Zolotarev. He's a journalist and political commentator who comes to you live via Skype out of Irkutsk in Russia. Sir, it's good to have you with us. Your ideas about what President Biden has just said about Russia and its possible use of chemical weapons, how credible are these?
Well, as credible as his claims and other presidents' claims about Syria's Russia's use so-called chemical and unconventional weapons in Syria. That's what the United States was using all the time, and that's what United States have been masters since forever. False flag. Maybe they're planning some sort of provocation, so they want to stage or they're planning some chemical leak to claim that Russia has been using chemical weapons to use it as a pretext for anything. I don't think they are planning to enter Ukraine from the NATO country's side, and I strongly believe that NATO will hold itself from entering Ukraine by some so-called peacekeeping mission. So I think it's just another part of his demented rhetoric.
And how serious would you say the threats or the proposal of excluding Russia from the group of G20 countries can be to the Russian officials?
Well, I think it is possible that they wipe out Russia from G20, though, as far as I know, not all the countries would support such decisions. So these ideas are pretty questionable. But I think actually it is possible because Russia, United States, and the whole West are in the state of war, actually, not just war as we used to know it, but pretty real economic measures. They can be called and considered as war. So I think Russia in war conditions with the West and the United States, so I think that it's possible. Though, we'll see.
All right. And when President Biden speaks of a united voice against Russia, as far as the Western leaders are concerned, your opinion, sir, how united would you say each and every Western state is, especially in terms of imposing further sanctions on Russia? Because this is the area where it seems there is not the consensus that President Biden is speaking about.
Well, I think their possibilities of imposing sanctions are close to be wasted, Because any closer and Russia starts imposing its own sanctions, which might be a gas embargo, oil embargo, or anything like this. So I think they are pretty much close to economic collapse of Europe. And rhetoric like this, well, they may impose or tighten already imposed sanctions, which may close some windows of possibility for Russia to avoid some sanctions, like using ruble as a payment for gas and oil. Though it's not for them actually now to choose whether to use ruble as a payment currency or not. Russia has been stern. You must, if you want Russian gas and oil. That's it. Mm-hmm. And they do not understand it yet, but Russia will not move back. Russia have spoken, and they have to deal with it. They say, we will have to cancel some sanctions or avoid some sanctions to pay in rubles. Mm-hmm. Look, Russia doesn't care what you have to do. If you want Russia's gas mm-hmm. and oil, you will pay in that currency which asks Russia. That's it. That's how I see it.
Well, that's I believe we just lost Dmitry Zolotarev. He is a journalist and political commentator out of Irkutsk, Russia. I really appreciate your time, sir. NATO leaders have held a summit in Brussels. Speaking to journalists after the meeting, the NATO chief said the Western military alliance has agreed to provide more support to Ukraine. Jens Stoltenberg also claimed Russia may be trying to create a pretext for the use of chemical weapons in Ukraine, an allegation that Moscow rejects.
Today, NATO leaders agreed that we must and will provide further support to Ukraine. We will continue to impose unprecedented costs on Russia, and we will reinforce Allied deterrence and defense. Leaders approved our four new battle groups in Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia. These are in addition to the four already in the Baltic countries and Poland. So we have eight multinational NATO battle groups now, from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea. So we are concerned, partly because we see the rhetoric, and we see that Russia is trying to create some kind of pretext, accusing Ukraine, United States, NATO allies, for preparing to use chemical and biological weapons. And we have seen before that this way of accusing others is actually a way to create a pretext for do the same themselves. And of course, the accusations against Ukraine and NATO allies are absolutely false.
The West is tightening the noose of sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. Now, the UK has blacklisted several Russian banks and industries. Britain has frozen the assets of Alpha Bank, which is one of Russia's top private lenders. It has also targeted Gazprom Bank, one of the main channels of payment for Russian oil and gas. The two banks, in addition to four others, will be locked out of any resources held in the UK. Russia's shipping firm Sovcomflot has also been placed on Britain's sanction list. Separately, Poland has reported blocked the Russian embassy bank, or bank accounts, I should say, it blocked it. And the Swiss government says it has frozen about $6 billion of Russian assets in Switzerland. Swiss banks are said to be holding some $200 billion worth of Russian wealth. Iran expresses concern about the escalating humanitarian situation in Ukraine and its surrounding regions. Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, stressed the need to respect the sovereignty of all nations and guarantees for safe passage of civilians and protection of civilian infrastructure. The Iranian diplomat called for de-escalation and an immediate halt to the conflict through dialogue. made their remarks after the UN General Assembly voted for a resolution criticizing Russia for its operation in Ukraine. The draft resolution was passed with 140 votes in favor, 5 against, and 38 abstentions, including by Iran. Tahrir Avanchi says the resolution's text included wordings that would go beyond the issue of settling the humanitarian crisis caused by the war. To other news now, the United States has warned of possible sanctions against Iran after Iranian military officials attended a defense exhibition in Qatar. The U.S. is deeply troubled by the presence of Iranian military officials in the exhibition. That's according to State Department spokesman Ned Price. He said his country rejects Iran's maritime defense exhibit. Price added transactions related to Iranian weapons are sanctionable under multiple U.S. authorities. Qatar held the exhibition in its capital city of Doha from March the 21st to the 23rd. Iran displayed some of its maritime defensive equipment as well as a number of its missiles and aircraft. Qatar is home to the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East. North Korea says it is prepared for a long confrontation with what it calls U.S. imperialism as it confirms testing an intercontinental ballistic missile. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who directly oversaw the test, said the missile is key to deter a nuclear war. He said Pyongyang is determined to strengthen a powerful nuclear deterrent. North Korean media say the newly launched missile is a new type of ICBM, which is the biggest the country has ever tested. South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. have condemned the Thursday missile launch. The U.S. has imposed new sanctions on North Korea. It has also imposed sanctions on a number of Russian individuals and entities, accusing them of providing sensitive items in North Korea's missile program. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, has given us more details about Pyongyang's latest missile test. She says the new missile can carry multiple warheads.
It has been nearly 5 years since the North tested an ICBM. This new ICBM, unlike the previous one in 2017, can carry multiple warheads. It can also carry decoys along with a real nuclear warhead. And that would confuse U.S. missile defense systems on the U.S. mainland. And experts are saying that U.S. missile defenses are woefully inadequate to deal with such an ICBM. So this is a real game changer, and this will definitely strengthen North Korea's position in any potential future negotiations with the U.S. Now, the Biden administration has said that it is willing to hold negotiations over the North's nuclear program, but the North feels that these are insincere efforts at denuclearization because the U.S. is continuing its hostile policy of sanctions and military drills.
French unions hold nationwide protests to voice their anger at President Emmanuel Macron's pledge to raise the retirement age if re-elected. On top of the demonstrations, an unlimited transport strike has just been called for Paris. Ramin Mazahiri is in the French capital.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence. But it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit. given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people die before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that's it with international news.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, we have currently taken up explanation of Surah Qamar, which was revealed in Mecca, and deals mainly with the punishment of disbelievers of the past generations as a warning to the pagans of Mecca and also to the disbelievers of all times, with the refrain, "Is there anyone who will be admonished?" running throughout the surah. The miserable fate of the disbelievers on the Day of Judgment is contrasted to the everlasting bliss the believers will enjoy in Paradise. An interesting feature of this surah is that all 55 of its ayahs end with the letter R. We continue from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 23, 24, 25, and 26, which read,
كذبت ثمود بالنذر فقالوا أبشرا منا واحدا نتبعه إنا إذا لفي ضلال وسعر ألقي الذكر عليه من بيننا بل هو كذاب أشر سيعلمون غدا من الكذاب الأشر.
The people of Thamud denied the warnings, and they said, are we to follow a lone human from ourselves? Indeed, then we would be in error and madness. Has the reminder been cast upon him from among us? Rather, he is a self-conceited liar. Tomorrow they will know who a self-conceited liar is. If you remember, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Qamar last Friday, we dwelt upon the fate of the rebellious nations to whom the prophets Noah and Hud were sent, saying, God raised prophets to invite people towards truth and salvation. But the obstinate disbelievers and sinners brought punishment upon themselves. We pointed out that water, wind, and other forces of nature are the creation of God Almighty and thus under His control as both a sign of divine mercy or wrath. We also noted that the Noble Quran is not a book of history, but relates selective accounts of the past nations in order to wake up human conscience to discover the truth. The ayahs that we recited to you now pertain to the people of Thamud in northern Arabia, amongst whom Prophet Saleh was raised to guide them to the path of the one and only Creator by warning them of the consequences of idol worship and committing of abominable sins. They scoffed at his words of guidance and continued their evil deeds, by ridiculing his warnings of the consequences of their wicked ways. Their pretext was that he was a human being like themselves and from their own community, so it would be a mistake to heed his call that God has entrusted him with the mission. Instead of giving such a mission to the people amongst us who have wealth and power, the disbelievers called Prophet Saleh a self-conceited liar, in response to which Ayah 26 means to say that soon it will be known as to who really are self-conceited liars, when divine wrath will befall the sinners. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, prophets lived a simple life like ordinary people, in order to be role models for the society. Number two, it is the habit of disbelievers and sinners to spurn the righteous and honest persons while accepting the rule of the tyrants and indulging in lustful ways, including atheism and polytheism. And number three, hypocrisy is the hallmark of godless societies where the self-conceited and liars dominate by calling the righteous persons and the seekers of truth as falsifiers. Now let us listen to ayahs 27, 28 and 29 of the same surah.
إِنَّا مُرْسِلُ النَّاقَةِ فِتْنَةً لَهُمْ فَارْتَقِبْهُمْ وَاصْطَبِرْ وَنَبِّئْهُمْ أَنَّ الْمَاءَ قِسْمَةٌ بَيْنَهُمْ كُلُّ شِرْبٍ مُحْتَضَرٍ فَنَادَوْا صَاحِبَهُمْ فَتَعَاطَى فَعَقَرٍ.
Indeed, we are sending the she-camel as a trial for them. So watch them and be steadfast. Inform them that the water is to be dispensed between them. Every drinking will be attended. But they called their companion, and he took a knife and hamstrung her. When the obstinate disbelievers demanded that they considered an impossible miracle for Prophet Saleh to bring forth from the mountain a red-haired 10-month pregnant camel that gives plenty of milk, the Almighty Creator answered the prayer of his prophet by splitting a huge rock from which, to the surprise of the disbelievers, emerged such a camel as a trial, as is indicated by the divine words, "So watch them and be steadfast." Ayah 28 sets the condition that the people of Thamud should make use of water from the stream one day and leave the stream to the she-camel the next day in order to receive milk in plenty from her in return, and every drinking will be recorded. As the next ayah means to say, even this great favor of plenty of free milk was met with ingratitude by the disbelievers of Thamud, who were determined to oppose Prophet Saleh and decided to kill the she-camel by entrusting the task to commit such an evil to one of their most wicked members. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, miracles are a form of trial to determine who are really seeking truth and who stubbornly stick to falsities. Number two, it is evil nature that responds with ingratitude to favors and blessings. Number three, God never punishes any people before sealing the argumentation for them. And number four, the enemies of the prophets and truth use rogues and hardened criminals to commit the most abominable acts of terrorism. In conclusion of this week's episode, here are ayahs 30, 31, and 32 of Surah Qamar.
فَكَيْفَ كَانَ عَذَابِي وَنُذُرْ إِنَّا أَرْسَلْنَا عَلَيْهِمْ صَيْحَةً وَاحِدَةً فَكَانُوا كَهَشِيمِ الْمُحْتَضِرِ وَلَقَدْ يَسَّرْنَا الْقُرْآنَ لِلذِّكْرِ فَهَلْ مِن مُدَّكِرْ.
So how were my punishment and my warnings? We sent against them a single cry, and they became like the dry sticks of a coral builder. Certainly we have made the Quran simple for admonishment. So is there anyone who will be admonished? When the she-camel was killed, the All-Merciful Lord, after commanding Prophet Saleh and a few believers to leave the region, struck the people of Thamud with divine wrath in the form of a horrible cry that turned the disbelievers into lifeless bodies that resembled dried up and mashed plants gathered as fodder for cattle. The metaphorical expression employed in the ayah regarding the torment that struck the Thamud is quite wondrous and meaningful, since God Almighty created a thundering sound that smashed everything within a wide expanse to shatter the rock-hewn mansions and turn the disbelievers into corpses resembling fodder for cattle. Ayah 32 poses the question whether such admonitory and excruciating fate is not sufficient to awaken mankind. Is there anyone who receives admonition from the Noble Quran and its vivid and crystal clear expressions, accounts, and warnings? These ayahs teach us that, number one, a nation whose members are comrades in crimes against humanity is liable to be struck by divine wrath. Number two, none can stand against God's will, which prevails over all and everything. And number three, the Quran is not a book of history, but it gives an accurate narration of selective events of the past in order to wake up human conscience to help discover the truth.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
From arms sales, the increase of soldiers, to what has been described as a controversial statements coming from Russia and the U.S. in terms of the accusations that it has leveled, the conflict in Ukraine is reaching new highs. At this point, some of the developments, it appears to be continuation of the talks being jeopardized, as the U.S. has said, as Russia has said, by the U.S. trying to come in and try to disturb that. Let's move on, however, and introduce our guest. Frank Emspach is a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin who joins us from Madison. Also joining us, Marcus Papadopoulos is a historian, political analyst, and author who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, both of you, welcome to the program. Frank Emspach, let me first start with you. We're looking at an influx of weapons. Aside from the almost $1 billion that the U.S. announced, we're looking at certain details that are coming out, like the Pentagon, as it was reported, scrambling to restock weapons sent to Ukraine. Congress giving the Pentagon $3.5 billion for that effort. How do you assess this influx of weapons that a large portion of it is coming from the U.S.?
Well, I think that the one organization that probably is not interested in ending the war in the Ukraine is the Pentagon. The longer this goes on, the more it costs the Russians, both in terms of their economy, public relations, and practically every other measure of diplomacy. So probably the Pentagon is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. But I think that we need to be serious about this in this way. Clearly, there has been a huge influx of arms. I think last year it was $1 billion. It's almost like a Stinger missile for every Ukrainian. And I think that the consequences of that are to stoke the likelihood of a continuing and wider war. So if we're going to move beyond where we are today, there has to be an agreement to obviously end the military conflict and not continue to engage in military activities there on our part or the Russians' part. I think this is going to be very, very hard to achieve because right now it appears that the United States, for a variety of reasons, politically, economically, is gaining.
What do you mean by a wider war?
Well, I think the longer this goes on, there will be more and more pressures, the likelihood of mistakes. Perhaps somebody says, well, you know, we can't do a low no-fly zone, but we want to guarantee navigation in the Black Sea. Who knows? You know, there's just such a great, great possibility of miscalculation here that I think that to sort of risk that under these circumstances is folly.
Okay. Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, as if it wasn't bad enough, the threat that Russia feels NATO countries, soldiers have by it moving closer to Russia, here you have the news of Biden might be announcing plans to put more troops in NATO, where we're understanding that he wants to permanently maintain an increased number of troops in NATO countries near Ukraine. I believe the number at this point ranges anywhere from 100 to 150,000 U.S. soldiers. Isn't that a provocation of some kind, going flatly against what Russia is saying, that this types of moves is what is a threat to Russia?
Well, I have to say that whilst the situation in Eastern Europe is extremely disconcerting, at the same time, the American response to the Russian military campaign in Ukraine has been far more responsible than the hysterical response of the British ruling elite. And I believe the reason for that is quite simple. The Americans are one of the nuclear superpowers in the world. And as a result of that, the Americans have profound obligations to mankind. And therefore, whilst the Americans will continue to arm the Ukrainian armed forces and to arm the Ukrainian nationalist paramilitary groups, such as the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion, at the same time, Washington is very much committed to maintaining its communication channels with the Kremlin. And the Kremlin, whilst it will persist with its military campaign in Ukraine, which after nearly 4 weeks has been exceedingly successful to the point where something like 30% of Ukrainian territory is now controlled by the Russian army, at the same time, Moscow wants to keep open its channels of communication with Washington because Russia and America are the nuclear superpowers in the world. Therefore, they have a responsibility not just to one another, but to the world in general. And I think we also need to be very clear about something. All that we see happening as regards the West, in terms of the sanctions it has placed on Russia, in terms of how Russian aircraft are banned from entering Western airspace, and the flow of Western weapons to the Ukrainian armed forces and to Ukrainian paramilitaries, is not about Ukraine per se. It is not about democracy in Ukraine and freedom in Ukraine and human rights in Ukraine. No. The response from the West is all about Russia. Namely, it is about asphyxiating the Russian economy so that that will lead to the death of the Russian state, so that America will be again, as it was in the 1990s and in the 2000s, the only global superpower. The Americans are aware that their objectives in Venezuela and Syria were ultimately defeated by Russia. Russia was able to defeat American objectives in those countries because it is a superpower.
Frank Imspach, do you agree?
I think the issue is hegemony here, and that the United States does not intend to become number two. And I've had this feeling for many years, and it's part of the American psyche after World War II. We won, we're in charge. And I think that this is a very dangerous period because of that, because obviously looking at the situation, particularly if you look at the combination of both Russia and China and the kind of money that's being put into scientific and technological research, in China in particular, there is a limited lifespan here in terms of America, the United States being the number one all the time on any major subject. And I think that when a power like ours is in that kind of transition, it is extremely dangerous because people in charge don't want to see that happen.
One of the things that was interesting, Marcus Papadopoulos, is the fact that we're looking at how the U.S. is not only Russia, but also it's being covered as such by certain media that it is discouraging the Ukrainian President Zelensky from actually making concessions to Russia that could end the fighting, saying that the U.S. perhaps is preventing those talks from being fruitful. The State Department signaling that the U.S. saying that the war is bigger than Russia and Ukraine and is about universal principles. Do you think that the U.S. Has that intention, and what are its gains behind it?
Ever since the American engineered coup in Kiev in February of 2014, Ukraine has been a vassal state of the West. Therefore, it follows whoever has been prime minister and president in the Ukrainian government has been selected by the Americans. There is no doubt about that whatsoever. And turning to Zelensky, he is merely a puppet. And whilst I strongly suspect he is starting to realize the malevolent nature of his masters in Washington, London, and Brussels, nonetheless, he has very little leeway in all of this. Why? Because he accepted the post of president with conditions. And once you enter a pact with the devil, so to speak, it is almost impossible to get out. And that is why the Americans are really in charge in Kiev. What Zelensky says to the rest of the world has been prepared by script writers in the Pentagon, in the State Department, and of course in the White House. And the Americans, even before the Russian military campaign in Ukraine, were looking for an opportunity to goad the Kremlin into taking some sort of military action in Ukraine, knowing that that would give America the opportunity it had been seeking for some years now to impose the most potent sanctions on Russia that the West has ever imposed on another country in its history. So the Americans knew that the Russians would at some point take military action in Ukraine. Now that the Russians have taken military action there, of course, the Americans are looking to draw out the conflict by increasing the flow of arms to the Ukrainian armed forces and Ukrainian nationalist paramilitary groups in the hope that this that Ukraine will become a bleeding wound for the Russian economy, which could bring about a collapse of the Russian government. The reality, of course, is that the Russian people are looking at the fighting in Ukraine as 1941 all over again, when Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union. They are resolutely behind President Putin. If there are going to be countries which will suffer or potentially suffer tremendously from the West's economic crusade against Russia, it will be Western countries. Ordinary people in Europe, for example, will struggle to pay the huge increase in electricity and gas and foodstuffs.
Okay, Frank Emsbach, let's take a look at a couple of stats here before I ask the question from you. We're looking at what the Russian foreign minister has said about the deployment of international peacekeepers in Ukraine, which was a move proposed by Poland. He said that could lead to direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. Then you have NATO, who are going to, the news coming out before their meeting, to deploy four new battle groups that are going to that's going to happen in Bulgaria, Hungary, Romania, Slovakia, based on the NATO Secretary General making that announcement. You have already the increase of U.S. Soldiers that's been announced, and it is happening. And I'm giving you all those stats to ask you this question, where Russia has said that if it feels that if there is an existential threat to Russia, that it will consider using nuclear weapons. It seems like there is an existential threat. If you agree, do you think that Russia then will use nuclear weapons?
Well, I certainly hope not, because then it's game over. That was my point earlier about that there are so many things that can go wrong here, that it's an extremely dangerous thing, not only for the Ukrainians or the Russians or anybody else in Western Europe, but the planet. And I hope that this doesn't happen. The best thing to do is not to continue increasing the troops and increasing the armaments. I think we have to understand that. The United States, in their treaty, we have a treaty with Ukraine, a direct treaty, bypassing NATO and bypassing other things. And Secretary of State Blinken said about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, we will never, he used the word never, agree to a situation where Ukraine is demilitarized and a neutral state, something to that effect. And that we will never agree that Ukraine does not have a right to join whoever it wants. Those are very strong diplomatic terms. And so whatever the stuff behind the scenes is, the stuff right out in public is pretty clear as regards our war aims, the United States war aims there, all of which is extremely dangerous. And I think any person of goodwill at this point in the world has got to say, ceasefire, stop the arms race, and begin to withdraw. Because if we don't do that, then something will happen. Look, you've got, aside from anybody deliberately using nuclear weapons, you got 6 or 8 nuclear reactors there, or 10 or whatever. And, you know, all of those are dangerous. Something can go wrong. The electricity goes out. There's no water and things like that. So this is an extremely volatile situation. And I think that we have a responsibility to say to the world leaders and everybody, enough. You have to have a ceasefire. NATO cannot keep putting troops on somebody's border and hope that, you know, in the that is going to work out, and the Russians have to get at least some sense that Ukraine is not going to be used as a springboard against them.
Okay.
Without that, we're not going to get very far here.
Well, unfortunately, the news just keeps getting worse with this special military operation, as Russia calls it. Marcus Papadopoulos, since the sources that I wanted to use, I couldn't confirm through the facts as they presented, I'd like to ask you the information that you may have. And the subject is the flood of what's called foreign fighters going into Ukraine. You have this legion of soldiers, I think, that President Zelensky actually formed, inviting, foreign fighters or soldiers from abroad, if you can call them that. But Russia has labeled that as foreign fighters, as mercenaries. So it's actually puts a question mark on it. What is the story behind that, both from the Ukrainian side and from the Russian side, if it's true?
We must be mindful that the propaganda emanating from the Ukrainian government, especially Zelensky, is extremely crude, is extremely childish. And I believe that applies to the claims by the Ukrainian government and Zelensky, quotes that thousands upon thousands of foreign volunteers have arrived in Ukraine. I find that extremely difficult to believe. Indeed, I find most of what emanates from Kyiv regarding the fighting in Ukraine to be totally unbelievable. The very fact that American mainstream media and British mainstream media pay credence to everything that comes out of the mouth of Zelensky just simply demonstrates that Western mainstream media is neither free nor independent nor impartial. But it is true there are some foreign citizens fighting in Ukraine. And we need to understand that, for example, in regard to Britain, that is a criminal offence. British citizens are prohibited by UK law from fighting in another conflict. And I would say this, and also we need to understand that foreign fighters do not have any rights under the Geneva Convention. And in terms of the British volunteers who went to Ukraine, some of whom have actually died in Ukraine, I would say this. The British Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, who is, of course, not a trained diplomat, she's trying to make a name for herself, is partly responsible because she encouraged British nationals to travel to Ukraine to fight, knowing it is illegal under UK law, and she never told the British population that foreign fighters in Ukraine, or indeed in any conflict anywhere around the world, have no rights under the Geneva Convention. So I believe that Liz Truss has a lot of explaining to do, but at the same time, the numbers which Zelensky is claiming about foreign fighters in Ukraine are quite simply inflated massively.
Frank Emsbeck, so if you maybe test your memory here and tell us how the different wars that the U.S. has been involved in, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Syria itself, or in Afghanistan, just to name a few, usually there's special operatives that are on the ground in those wars, in those war scenarios, that are not called U.S. soldiers, perhaps, but they carry special operations, I guess. So do you think that there are special, people who are trained under the U.S., perhaps special operations that are on the ground in Ukraine that perhaps are training Ukrainian soldiers there, which brings about the question whether the U.S. at this point is involved in this war. Whether it's like it or not, it says that, you know, we're not part of this war right now. We're not involved in it in that way.
Well, I have no idea what's going on in terms of special operations or anything like that. The United States withdrew their training contingent about the day the war began or a couple of days before to Poland. I think that there are people, because I've gotten on the plane, they've made announcements, volunteers, American citizens who are fighting in the Ukraine probably. And that's also a violation of different parts of American law. I think the scenario then becomes rescue Americans if something goes wrong, and that further complicates the proceedings. But, you know, it's hard to know, and I know in the 3 minutes that we have left, we're not going to solve the Ukrainian problem. But I go back to this. The more these things happen, the less likely it is that we're going to be able to solve this and to encourage people to go fight in the Ukraine, as is happening in the press here and some parts of it, is going to be the kind of trigger that causes intervention. It's happened before here. And I think that it's extremely dangerous. And I go back to this. We, people who are commenting like this, need to be able to stress that in order to move here, it's not a question of a secret or of anything else. It's quite out there. We have to insist that the American government stop the escalation, the Russian government agree with the United States for a ceasefire, and proceed from there. Because without that, something is going to happen here. I just don't think it's possible to conceive anything else.
Okay, we're going to have to unfortunately end it there. Thank you for that, Frank Emsbeck, Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin. Marcos Papadopoulos, thank you, historian, political analyst, and author. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mikhail Tatwe, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen, from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, welcome to your program. This is Arab English Radio. You're hearing me from Back to Reality. I am your humble host, Asma, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Brother Hassanain and Brother Sayyid Jaffa.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Very pleased to meet you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for being here. So, as the ritual of this program, at the very beginning, we ask about the academical background of your study. So, shall you please tell us a little bit about your study?
Yeah, sure. I'm Hassanain and I'm from India. I'm an Islamic seminary student and studying in here in Qom.
So, wish you all the best. And you, brother? You.
My name is Sayyid Jaffer. I'm from America. And I, myself, am also a seminary student. Studying here in Qom.
So wish you luck. Thank you for being here. Well, today we have a very interesting discussion because it is related to you both. Inshallah. We're going to learn a lot about seminary students. Well, tell us, what are the differences between the students of seminary now and the past? You and the generations before you. What are the differences? Has there anything that changed a lot in the way you study, in your books, in your professors?
If you're talking about the seminary life and the seminary students, specifically Hausa, of the old times and the present time Hausa, each time of Hausa has got its own factors.
Yes, because time changes.
Yeah, because time changes.
And people change, their mentality change.